Senators says one Afghan soldier has been killed in a firefight with assailants at the Kabul airport that also involved German and American forces. Iranian lawmakers are debating the proposed cabinet lineup of President Ebrahim Raisi for a third day. The U.S. city of Portland witnessing clashes between rival far-right and left-wing groups. Police arrest a man who opened fire on demonstrators. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Beginning with Afghanistan, German officials saying that an Afghan security force has been killed during a firefight at the airport in the Afghan capital, Kabul. The Unified Armed Forces of Germany says that there have been clashes between Afghan forces and unknown assailants at the north gate of the airport. American and German soldiers were also involved in the clashes. The Kabul airport has been the scene of chaos in the past days as thousands of people rushed there in a bid to flee the country amid the Taliban's takeover. More than 20 people lost their lives due to stampedes or gunshots there. Meantime, U.S. President Joe Biden has expressed concerns over the security situation at the Kabul airport.
The security environment is changing rapidly. There are civilians crowded at the airport, although we've cleared thousands of them. We know that terrorists may seek to exploit the situation and target innocent Afghans or American troops.
Biden warned against the possibility of terror attacks in Afghanistan and threats posed by the Afghan affiliates of the Daesh terrorist group. The U.S. president said that the pullout of American troops from Afghanistan might be extended beyond the deadline of August 31st, but the Taliban saying that foreign forces are working toward leaving Afghanistan on schedule and have not yet sought to extend the evacuation. Now, Iran is calling for an inclusive government in Afghanistan, urging all sides involved in the conflict to show restraint. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says that a conflict in that country has no military solution. It has to be settled politically and through dialogue. Khatibzadeh says that Iran is ready to facilitate such negotiations. He said what's unfolding in Afghanistan today is the result of U.S. policies in the war-torn country, which brought destruction and chaos. Khatibzadeh also urged the Taliban to protect Afghan civilians and set the stage for them to live in peace. He said Iran has always stood by the Afghan people, hosting millions of refugees from the country. The spokesman also called for humanitarian aid from the international community regarding the situation in Afghanistan. Now here in Iran, lawmakers have started another session of debating the proposed cabinet lineup of President Ebrahim Raisi. And this is the third day of reviewing the qualifications of the proposed ministers in parliament. Legislators began a process on Saturday after the president defended his choices at the parliament. The sessions include speeches by supporters and opponents of each nominee. The process will continue until Wednesday when a vote of confidence is expected. The president will have up to 3 months to name a replacement in case any of the proposed ministers fails to win the vote. Raisi has pledged to tackle the COVID pandemic and spur the economy as priorities of his government. Now, Egypt says it's closing the Rafah border crossing with Gaza, the only land opening to the rest of the world for Palestinians living in the besieged strip. A spokesman for the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, says that Cairo has informed Gazan authorities about shutting down the crossing as of Monday. Security source in Egypt has confirmed the news, saying it would be closed until further notice, without offering details or reasons. Egypt ordered the Rafah crossing to open in May to allow the people in Gaza wounded in then Israeli attacks to be treated or for the aid to be delivered. The Egyptian decision to close the border point comes after a weekend of violence between Israel and Palestinians in eastern Gaza. Rafah is a lifeline for Gazans who have been under a crippling Israeli siege since 2007. Okay, now let's go to Gaza. We have Ashraf Shannon, our correspondent there. Ashraf, with a situation like this, I think will further worsen the plight that the people in Gaza are going through with the border being closed again.
Yes, Mahrouz. Basically, what the Egyptian regime has done is has disrupted the lives of 2 million people living in the Gaza Strip under siege since 2007. And you have to understand that this siege was imposed by Israel and with the help of Egypt itself, because the Egyptian regime has kept the Rafah crossing closed most of the time since 2007, following the imposition of that inhumane and hermetic siege on the enclave by the Israeli regime, who not only imposed a blockade on Gaza, but waged multiple wars. And the recent one was in May of this year that resulted in the killing of scores of innocent civilians, mainly children and women. People in Gaza are not shocked by what Egypt has done. The southern neighbor of Palestine, Egypt, has for many years been supportive of the Israeli regime and the Israeli practices. Not only that, even when the crossing is open, people in Gaza complain that border officers, Egyptian border officers, often blackmail Palestinians who get a permit to leave Gaza and ask them for bribes in order to allow them passage through the Egyptian crossing. The Palestinian factions have condemned the move by Egypt. They stopped short of saying the say bad words against the Egyptian regime, because Egypt is the only lifeline that's available right now for 2 million civilians living in Gaza. Now, Egypt carried out this step or did this following the Israeli violence against peaceful protesters in the east of the enclave. Yes, there was some resistance, a resistance fighter who tried to defend the peaceful protesters by firing a pistol towards an Israeli sniper who was trying to kill Palestinian protesters. So basically, the Egyptians are not happy that Palestinians in Gaza are defending themselves.
And Ashraf, you talk about the May conflict that happened. I wonder how the reconstruction process went on with all these limitations.
Well, it's zero zilch nada. This is what happened. Israel has not allowed a single bag of cement to enter Gaza. The same thing with Egypt. The Egyptians did not allow any bag of cement to enter Gaza or of rebar for rebuilding. Or it's not only about rebuilding what Israeli regime has demolished and bombed. Also, there is a natural growth of population in Gaza. It's not only that building materials needed to rebuild the bombed buildings, also needed, you know, for people to carry on with their normal lives.
Exactly. Okay, thank you very much for that, Ashraf Shannon from Gaza. A Zionist organization has approved a plan that could lead to further expulsion of Palestinians from their homes in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Observers saying that the plan could encourage Israeli settlers to confiscate more Palestinian lands. Mona Kendall reports.
As part of a new plot to seize further Palestinian lands, the Jewish National Fund, a Zionist organization, has initially agreed to allocate $100 million U.S. dollars to register the Palestinian lands in East Al-Quds and the West Bank in name of settlers. The new plan could lead to the eviction of further Palestinians from their homes in the West Bank and East Al-Quds. According to Israeli Peace Now Group, the establishment is encouraging settlers to confiscate more Palestinian lands. The Peace Now noted that the right-wing regime of Israel is seeking to seize more Palestinian lands through the Jewish National Fund.
This regime will do anything in its power to first expand settlements and second to annex more Palestinian areas. And now, with the help of this gang establishment known as the Jewish National Fund, Bennett's regime is working to achieve his goal, that is to back illegal settlement construction.
The fund covers about 17,000 properties, most of them inhabited by Palestinians. Observers say this is the same scenario carried out earlier in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah in Al-Quds. Palestinian families are fighting legal battles to prove their ownership of the properties amid Israeli efforts to evacuate them forcefully from their homes. The Jewish National Fund is a Zionist organization founded in 1901 to buy and develop land in Ottoman and Mandatory Palestine for Jewish settlers. Earlier this year, Israeli media reported that Israeli authorities recruited the Jewish National Fund to secretly buy Palestinian land for settlers. Palestinians warn that the move by the Jewish National Fund is another proof for Israel's attempts to illegally seize more land in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds by forced expulsion of real owners. They say, however, that they will never back down and they will continue resisting these Israeli plans. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Now, in other news, the U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea says Washington does not have hostile intent toward Pyongyang and is open to meeting its leaders anytime, any place. Sung Kim made a comment upon arrival in Seoul on a 40 visit where he met with its South Korean counterpart, No Kyu Duk. Kim is an American diplomat of Korean descent. The visit comes as a brief thaw in inter-Korean relations in July turned into a new stand-up over joint U.S.-South Korean war games. Kim, however, defended the drills, saying they're pure defensive in nature. He said he'd agreed with Seoul to work together to resume dialogue with Pyongyang. The North had said it was open to diplomacy, but warned that American overtures appear hollow amid what are called hostile acts, such as the drills that could trigger a security crisis. Protests by rival far-right and left-wing groups in the U.S. city of Portland have descended into violence as the opposing sides engaged in clashes. Police arrested a man who opened fire on demonstrators. Nobody was hurt in the shooting. According to U.S. media, Proud Boys members attacked on vehicles and people they believed to be part of the rival group. The far-right group gathered in Portland on the anniversary of an extraordinarily violent clash that took place last summer. The demonstrations were part of a succession of street protests last year following the murder of George Floyd, a black man that was murdered by a Minneapolis police officer in May 2020. Meantime, catastrophic floodwaters have claimed the lives of more than a dozen people in the U.S. state of Tennessee. Officials say at least 22 people were killed, 51 others went missing after flash floods swept through middle Tennessee region. According to the National Weather Service, the devastation came after an estimated 8 to 10 inches of rain deluged Dixon, Hickman, Houston, and Humphreys counties. At least 4,200 people across the state have lost power. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says that her country would continue to stay in nationwide COVID-19 lockdown until Friday midnight. She warned that the Delta strain of the coronavirus needs more certainty, adding that New Zealand has not yet reached the peak of the outbreak. She also extended the lockdown in the city of Auckland, the epicenter of the new outbreak, until the end of the month. New Zealand went under a nationwide lockdown last week after the country registered its first case of coronavirus in more than 6 months. 100 people have been affected by the current outbreak of the highly transmissible Delta variant in the Pacific country. The United States has imposed new sanctions on Russia over its Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline project. The new measures target two Russian companies and a ship involved in the project. Analysts believe that the U.S. sanctions cannot have stopped the nearly completed project that would transfer Russian gas to Germany.
Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, an ambitious $11 billion project that would transport natural gas from Russia directly to Germany by bypassing Ukraine. The project will double the existing Nord Stream pipeline running from Russia to Europe across the Baltic Sea and is a sustainable way to ensure European energy security. The Nord Stream 2 project is close to completion, yet it has for long caused tensions between Moscow and Washington. The United States sees the project as a potential threat, believing that it will increase Europe's dependence on Russian gas exports and isolate Ukraine. As a matter of fact, by bypassing Ukraine, Russia and the European Union could save the transit fees that make up to 3% of Ukraine's GDP. In addition, Washington worries that Moscow's success in transferring natural gas to Europe would undermine the effectiveness of U.S. sanctions in place against the country since 2014 due to the conflict in Ukraine. On Friday, Washington slapped new sanctions on a ship and two entities involved in the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project. At the same time, U.S. President Joe Biden issued an executive order allowing for sanctions to be imposed on certain Russian officials. Although this deepens the rift between the U.S. and Russia, it is unlikely to have much impact on the nearly completed energy project. The U.S. and Germany had struck an agreement when it came to Nord Stream 2. The Biden administration waived sanctions on the company overseeing the construction of the pipeline and its chief operating officer, yet it goes ahead with sanctioning Russian officials. It appears that the U.S. is still after sabotaging this project.
But basically, they're trying to look tough, even though they're kind of surrendering, because it's clear that the Nord Stream will take place. Who is very much kind of stand to lose as a result of that is Ukraine, because, you know, Ukraine utilizing the oil pipeline, more or less 20% of their income depends on that. So Ukraine is going to lose money. And that's what the United States' interest is. They ask Germany to help. They don't want to pay themselves, so they push Germany to help Ukraine. But so that's the bottom line. But, you know, so they can sanction the Russians, but they more or less will have to agree with the Nord Stream to go on.
Now, on the first anniversary of the alleged poisoning of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny, Britain and the U.S. have imposed joint sanctions on Russia. They target the individuals that Washington and London say are Russian intelligence operatives responsible for Navalny's poisoning. The move appears to be part of a maximum pressure campaign that the U.S. has launched against Russia.
Britain and the U.S. both targeted seven Russians with sanctions and also issued a joint statement warning Russia over chemical weapons. The targeted Russian individuals are described as Russian security officials allegedly involved in a nerve attack on Navalny last year. This is while Moscow has denied any involvement in the incident. Washington separately imposed sanctions on another two men and four Russian institutes it said were involved in chemical weapons research or what it described as an assassination attempt against Navalny. Navalny was poisoned using a nerve agent. He was flown to Germany for medical treatment after falling ill in Siberia on August 20th last year. Though he survived, he was arrested in January when he returned to Russia. The U.S. has been on the forefront with anti-Russia rhetoric over Navalny's case, including his alleged poisoning. This is while Kremlin has said it will not allow any foreign interference in its domestic affairs. In response to the latest round of sanctions over Nord Stream 2 and the Navalny case, Russian Foreign Ministry condemned the measures as unilateral and illegitimate, vowing that Moscow's response to sanctions will be tough and appropriate.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Well, this is the camping mat, the flashlight, and these are the trekking poles. As you may have guessed, I'm packing my backpack for a hiking trip. I'm really excited because my trip is to one of the very beautiful regions of Iran, to Nahr Lake in Ardabil province. Nahr Lake is a lake located at the borderline of two provinces of Gilan and Ardabil. This lake is situated 48 kilometers southeast of Ardabil along Khalkhal route in one of the valleys of Baghru mountain. This lake is at the altitude of 2,500 meters above the sea level. Nahr Lake consists of a smaller and a larger lake that get connected in spring, forming a single lake. The average depth of this lake reaches 5 meters. Nahr Lake is a natural freshwater lake. Enough precipitation and abundant springs have made this lake a permanent one. This region has a wide variety of terrestrial and aquatic plants. This lake has ecological, ecotourism, beekeeping, livestock, and agricultural values. The Nahr Lake is also home to some species of migratory birds. Hunting any bird in this lake is illegal. What a punishing path Nahr Lake has! Oh, this is slope ends in the lake. I can hardly breathe. I have to take a rest. Oh my God, Nahr Lake. Looks like a beautiful postcard. It's green as far as the eye could see. This lake looks like a blue gem which shines in the middle of a meadow. Let's get closer to see what's happening there. I am now beside Neor Lake. Nature travelers have camped outside around the lake. On the other side of the lake, where it seems to be calm, some people are fishing. Because of being a freshwater lake, Neor has provided a highly suitable habitat for the fish. In late summer, fishing competitions are held in this region. However, as a nature traveler, I am against the idea of any kind of hunting or fishing. Oh, look! How many horses are here? How beautiful they are! One of them is with black spots. Reminds me of Rakhsh, Rostam's horse. As you know, Rostam is one of the heroes of Iranian legends. Here you can hire a horse and go horseback riding around the lake. The mud in some parts of the Neor Lake is swampy, and that is why swimming is forbidden in this lake. Ooh, what a cold weather! I'd better wear my jacket before I catch a cold. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. Well, Lebanon has been under economic pressure for at least 2 years now, from major currency devaluation to lack of fuel and electricity. The Lebanese people have been targeted. Now, according to the leader of the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, it is the United States which is mostly behind the suffering of the Lebanese people. We'll be talking about what is happening in Lebanon and why. I want to start it off by welcoming our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh. Mariam, well, please, fill us in. We heard Sayed Hassan speak tonight. Fill us in on where we are right now in the situation in Lebanon.
Well, it's basically a brief White House speech today. He was able to highlight the major problem and what the problem is. And although he said that we do have mismanagement, we do have a lot of corruption in the country. However, what we're witnessing right now is a battle. It is a battle being forced upon Lebanon by the U.S., and it is being orchestrated by the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. He did specify and stress that the main reason for the lack of provision, the lack of fuel, the fact that the major companies are not distributing fuel, the fact that even that we have monopolizers, even that is being orchestrated. by the U.S. And smuggling of fuel out of the country, smuggling of, as he said previously, smuggling of U.S. dollars outside the country was also orchestrated by the U.S. in order to choke the Lebanese people. And what he stressed on today was the fact that this is not only targeting Hezbollah, it is not only targeting the supporters of Hezbollah and the resistance and all those nationalist people and the patriots in the country, it's also targeting everyone, even those that are the allies or the so-called friends of the U.S. And he also called on them to heed this fact that they will not be gaining anything from all of this. He also highlighted the fact that after Hezbollah's, the Secretary General had declared that a shipment of fuel will be leaving Iran before Ashura, and today he declared there will be another ship which will be coming into to Lebanon in the coming days. He said that this coincided with promises, which he called empty promises, from the U.S. ambassador here in Beirut, but saying that the U.S. will work on negotiating and bringing in funds from the World Bank in order to bring in gas from Egypt through Jordan and Syria. And he said that these are false claims. Why? Because this requires several issues. First of all, it requires that the U.S. Congress itself approve such a movement, because it also requires that the Lebanese government negotiates and holds talks with the Syrian government, which the U.S. Is, of course, prohibiting, in order for the Syrian government to allow that gas to come into Lebanon through its territories. Of course, he spoke about so many issues. There's not enough time to perhaps brief them all, but the major point is that Hezbollah is on their way to bringing in fuel into Lebanon in order to ease the tension, to ease the sanctions. This is something that is perhaps very major and very close to what we saw in the war in the year 2006. That was considered a major confrontation directly between the U.S. That was a war enforced upon Lebanon by the U.S., of course, through its tools, tool specifically Israel. Now we have another form of a war, which is majorly economic and social. And we see here Hezbollah very clearly confronting, and as the Secretary General said, that they would once again be victorious.
Thank you very much for that update. Out of Beirut, that's Maryam Saleh. I'd like to welcome now my guest, Spotlight, journalist and political analyst Elijah McNear, out of Brussels. And Professor of International Studies at the University of Tehran, Mohammed Manandi, out of Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. I'd like to start this off in Tehran. Mohammed, you heard what Maryam was saying, and of course it was a summary of what the Secretary General has said. Why is it that, first of all, if you agree with the analysis, why is it that the United States would want to see the Lebanese people suffer? What do they want to get out of this?
Well, the United States wants Israel to be able to dominate the territories surrounding it. So they would like to see Egypt as a failed state. They would like to see Jordan as a failed state, and both of them are failed states. And they would like to see Syria, which was a strong country broken to a degree. They've achieved that. The Syrians, of course, have fought back, and they've been able to defeat much of what the Americans and NATO has thrown at them, the dirty war and Al-Qaeda and ISIS to a large degree, but it has still caused enormous suffering, and now the Americans have imposed sanctions on the Syrians that are an attempt to achieve what they couldn't achieve through the dirty war. The same is true with Lebanon. The United States wants to crush Lebanon. It wants to destroy the social fabric in order to bring down the resistance against Israel so that Israel can dominate. It's a tool, the sanctions that the Americans use across the world. They crush nations. They crush people. If you don't see it in the news, it's not something that's dramatic. People die quietly, whether it's Venezuela or Cuba or Libya or Yemen, through the barbaric starvation siege that the Americans helped the Saudis impose. And they did it in Iraq. If you remember, during Saddam Hussein, the Saddam Hussein that they created and gave chemical weapons to, later on they sanctioned Iraq because of the Saddam Hussein that they created. And when 500,000 children had died because of the sanctions, the U.S. Secretary of State said, it's worth it. So this is not new. These tactics, these policies are not new. The Americans know exactly what they're doing. They are brutal, they are barbaric, they're inhumane, but they are the norm. And the very fact that the Western media really doesn't say anything about this shows that Western countries don't have a free media. Okay. They're all controlled by the powers that be.
Okay. Well, Elijah, what do you think? You heard Mohammed said basically the U.S. is implementing policy that it does all over. I want to look at that aspect, because it just seems that if that's the case, it's a copy-paste type of scenario, trying to create failed states, as Mohammed said, throughout the region and beyond. It just seems that there would be lessons that people would learn from other states, because we see inside of Lebanon there are some various groups that either buy into what is being said, or because they perhaps benefit from the suffering itself. What do you make of that side of things, and what needs to be done? I mean, Said Hassan Nasrallah talked tonight about basically it's not one group, or it's not Hezbollah that's being targeted, but all of the Lebanese people. So they are all in it together.
Absolutely. What the Americans are doing is trying to break the back of the axis of the resistance by economic sanction and pushing the state of Lebanon, Syria, even Iraq and Iran into a failed state. But because they have failed militarily in breaking Hezbollah in 2006, breaking Syria in 2011, and Iraq in 2014, and they want to divide the country, and also imposing the harshest sanction on Iran, so they're changing their style into a sanction now to starve the population. But what they are doing is, in some places, like in Lebanon, is turning against the Americans, because the Americans have friends in every country where the axis of the resistance is deployed and exists, where there is a society that formed this axis of the resistance. However, the more the Americans are tightening the rope again around the neck of the member of the axis of the resistance, the more this axis of the resistance is finding other ways to come out and take the benefit of these sanctions and these harsh period, and turning them into positive opportunity. So we see the solidarity among the axis of the resistance that is very important in this case. And thanks to the Iranian support to Hezbollah in Lebanon, Iran is sending one ship starting a few days ago, and then it's followed by other ships, as Sayyid Nasrallah said. That means the Iran is not leaving its the member of the axis of the resistance that represent part of its national security and part of this one nation that is standing against the U.S. hegemony, and is trying to support Lebanon as possible. Now, Iran is not going to substitute the country, the government, and is not going to be able to support another state, exactly what Iran did in Syria. It has managed to make sure that the Syrian will not starve, and what it's trying now to do is managing to make sure that the Lebanese are not going to starve, and they're not going to just submit to what the Americans are doing, because the Americans want Hezbollah to deliver its weapon to serve Israel, so Israel can benefit from defeating Hezbollah when they fail to do that militarily. And I don't think this is going to happen, because now Hezbollah is gaining more popularity, because what Sayyid Nasrallah said, that the Iranian oil will be distributed to all hospitals regarding their religion or their belief, to all bakeries, to all the wherever there is an industry of a medical industry, and that will be distributed equally.
Okay.
Now, it's not going to be able to satisfy the population, but it's going to at least come out of this harsh sanction.
What about that, Mohammed? I mean, the leader of Hezbollah said that they talked about the fuel being brought in from Iran, and that it's not just one ship, but it's an opening to a whole new path. And he also talked about people being wrong about these international sanctions on Iran. He says these are unilateral, illegal U.S. sanctions that are illegal, and people have to think beyond that. Your take on this whole act with Iran and sending fuel, tell me about the importance of that and perhaps being able to break this whole hegemonic control that these certain Western states think that they have in this region.
If one reads the Western media or watches Western media outlets, one would think that these are indeed international sanctions, but they're only American sanctions. But I think that is a part of Eurocentricism, that's their racism kicking in, that's their exceptionalism kicking in, where they think that if they, the Europeans, the Americans, the Australians, the New Zealanders, if they impose sanctions, that means the world has imposed sanctions, because they are the international community. That's how they see the world. That's how they view themselves. That's how they call themselves the civilized world and the rest of us the uncivilized world. They call themselves the free world and the rest of us the unfree world. But the free world is not going to hear anything about the atrocities being committed by their own armies, by their own soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya, and the way in which they're crushing the populations of Cuba or Venezuela through sanctions, or Iran for that matter, preventing Iran from importing masks, preventing Iran from importing vaccines and the equipment to produce vaccines. They're not going to hear that, because the free world doesn't give that sort of information to their public. So we should expect nothing but this sort of representation, this sort of narrative building in the West, where Western sanctions or American sanctions are universal sanctions. No, these are sanctions imposed by the Godfather, the United States being the global Godfather, and the Iranians are not going to accept that. And the Iranians broke the sanctions imposed by the Godfather against Venezuela. They did it against Syria. Now they're going to do it against Lebanon, because okay. This is one of the best ways to defeat American hegemony, to show that these sanctions can be broken and that the Americans cannot do anything about it. That encourages other powers like China and Russia to do the same on other fronts.
Well, Elijah, as Said Hassan says, pointed the finger at the American embassy in Lebanon as the main culprit, trying to destabilize Lebanon. Let's talk about the role of what's supposed to be a diplomatic entity, but basically trying to cause chaos. And of course, Said Hassan even talked about goal being civil war in Lebanon.
The American is like a country, and like the decision maker in the country, to the point that the American ambassador just phoned the president to tell him about a new plan to drag gas from Egypt and Jordan through Syria and to Lebanon, just as the reaction to what Syed Nasrallah said about the Iranian and diesel oil tankers that are coming to Lebanon. And by communicating that via phone without showing any documents or any plan or any thoughtful ideas, the Americans are, first of all, just dealing extremely rudely with the president of Lebanon. Secondly, just not asking Syria its opinion, notwithstanding the Caesar Act that imposed sanctions on Syria, and how this plan is going to be materialized. Thirdly, this plan, if materialized, needs a year, which means the Lebanese population should wait for the blessing of the American to receive their gasoline, and all that forwarded by the U.S. Embassy in Lebanon. So it's like acting like the decision maker in the country, but reacting really surprisingly lightly as an ambassador. And I think what is really driving the American off the hook is because Saeed Nasrallah and Iran are spoiling the plan of the U.S. to starve the population and to turn their guns against Hezbollah and to blame Hezbollah for the dear situation in the country, when the ally of the U.S., the corrupted ally of the U.S., are the source of the situation and the financial crisis. So, yes, the Americans are behaving like they are the decision maker in the country.
Spoiling the plans of the United States is what Elijah said, Muhammad. I think that's probably the main problem that the United States has with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And now if we look at the resistance front, we see that pressure has been increased across the axis. But at the same time, we don't see any part of the resistance acquiescing. I mean, what exactly does that say? What message does that send to the United States and its allies?
The most important thing is that it shows that the members of this alliance or this axis of resistance, they're not proxies. These are people who have a mutual belief, a similar ideological understanding of how things are in the world today. They're anti-imperialist. They're anti-American hegemony. They want the Americans off their backs, whether it's in Yemen or Syria or Iraq or Lebanon or Palestine or Afghanistan or Iraq. The United States has built an empire and has manipulated the people of the region for many decades, and the Europeans before the Americans. So the West as a whole has been a very destructive force in this region, just like everywhere else in the world. And therefore, no matter how much pressure the Americans impose on the populations, even though there are going to be people who side with the Americans, these elites or these business people or these westernized figures in each society will advocate American policy, the bulk of these societies know what the United States stands for. It stands for oppression, it stands for injustice, and it stands for hierarchy.
Okay, I'm going to have to just jump in here because I'm going to throw it back at Elijah just for the last minute. Now, Elijah, many would say that the main problem for Washington and its allies is actually that the resistance is stronger than ever, both inside of Lebanon and beyond. And it's in a situation now, they're in a situation that they will do anything possible to stop this wave of the axis of resistance. Your take in 1 minute.
I don't think it's too late for the Americans to do anything to stop the course of the path of the axis of the resistance. I think Americans are on their way out from West Asia. They've left Afghanistan humiliated. They're going to do that in Iraq, and they're going to fail in Lebanon dramatically, as they are failing in Gaza with their Israeli ally. And they're exactly failing again in Syria, even if they're starving the population. I think the determination of the axis of the resistance is much stronger, and the occupier is destined is only to the dustbin of history.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us on this spotlight. Elijah McNair, a journalist and political analyst out of Brussels, and right here in Tehran, Professor of International Studies from the University of Tehran, Mohammad Marandi. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints you are listening to. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Please accept our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the arrival of the month of Muharram. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers, Dr. Mohammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani, a faculty member of the University of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, doctor. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to you.
You're welcome, brother. And also, brother Ali Alavian is over here, an Islamic expert from the Islamic House of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother, and very welcome to this show.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you for having me here.
So, since this is the month of Muharram and the most tragic event during the history took place in this month, that is the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions and family members, his faithful, loyal companions, Brother Mahmoud, the producer of this program, decided to dedicate this session and the upcoming ones to the atrocities and the corruptions that were done by the Umayyads during their rulership over Muslim lands. Let's get to the most harsh event of the history.
Yeah.
That is the tragic event of Karbala and the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Yeah, Muawiyah, the notorious Muawiyah, selected his son, the playboy, the womanizer, the guy who was always drunk.
The true profligate.
The profligate. A man who did profane, a man who attacked Kaaba. Who attacked Kaaba, man? During the history. Who attacked Kaaba? The house of Allah. Yazid did that. So see how much notorious and how much corrupted a person could be. I do want to say, do not look at the tragic event of Karbala and killing of Imam al-Hussein. He did not do mercy toward Kaaba, the house of Allah. Mm. Some people say, okay, the atrocity toward Imam al-Hussein was this and that. He attacked Kaaba. He demolished it, man. At the time of Abdullah ibn Zubair, it was. He was the governor of that time. Of course, they had their own problems too. We do not confirm them or we do not approve them. But brother, Yazid got the power. And even when you ask some of our Sunni brethren about Yazid, they are embarrassed. Say, okay, he was a disgrace to the whole, we can say, Muslim Ummah. And we are sorry that Yazid was selected as the next successor and king to the Muslim power on that time. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam cannot tolerate brother Ali al-Abiyan.
Yeah.
Starts his movement and uprises against Yazid. Mm-hmm. Now, talk a little bit about the roots for us.
When this peace treaty that Imam Hassan alayhi salam wrote with Muawiyah, we read it, we see that among one of these conditions that we referred to earlier, it was said that the successorship should not be at the hand of Muawiyah, rather it has to be at the hand of Imam Hassan, and it has to actually continue in the right way that it was mentioned. Okay, Muawiyah did not accept this condition, and as doctor said, he tore it in front of people, and he said, I just wanted to take the power. And the expediency of the Islamic Ummah, the few number of Muslims at the time of Imam Hassan who were supposed to help him, because, you know, the loyal companions of Imam Ali alayhi salam, Imam Hassan, some of them were martyred in Nahrawan, some in Safin, some in recent battles at that time, close to his father's time, and so he had very few people with him. And even when he signed the treaty with Muawiyah, some of the even close companions of Imam actually criticized him of why have you signed this treaty. So I wanted to portray
the situation
of the time.
Yes.
So anyhow, he took the power against whatever was agreed earlier.
You mean Yazid?
Yazid, yeah. Yes. Muawiyah selected his son against whatever has been agreed earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So he appointed him as the leader of the Islamic Ummah. And it's beautiful for us to know that even the Prophet actually has predicted such scenes that
Yes.
In a dream that he saw monkeys are climbing and going up off the member of the Holy Prophet.
Of the Rasulullah,
he was embarrassed of this dream, and it is said that in this hadith that after that dream, no one saw the Prophet even smiling till the time of his demise.
Let me claim the references
from
the Shia side, Sheikh Al-Tusi and Muhaddis Bahrani. And from our Sunni brethren, Suyuti and Alusi have narrated the great narration of Prophet Muhammad in reference to...
Its interpretation, it comes
yes.
out, it refers to this event.
Event, that's right. And this Shajaratul Mal'una, which is the cursed...
The accursed dynasty.
Dynasty, or the accursed family tree, as they say. This is Surah Isra, Ayah 60. So Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam could not tolerate Yazid. Nobody could.
Look, Imam Hussein, when he saw, even based on the treaty that was written and was signed from two sides, he knew that it's his own right to take the leadership of the Islamic Ummah.
Okay.
But the other side, that is Yazid, is asking him to come and pay allegiance to me. And Imam tells him, a person like me never actually pays allegiance with a person like you.
That's right.
So this is the starting point of this, actually... quarrel, which leads to Imam's going, and he wants, and Yazid wants the governor of Medina to force Imam Hussein alayhi salam to accept the allegiance.
Al-Khalafatu Muharrama ala Abi Sufyan. This is the narration of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam narrating.
This is a prophetic hadith.
No, I know. This is what Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam quoted
from